It's 1934. A decorated Marine Corps Major General, two-time Medal of Honor recipient, walks into a congressional hearing and testifies under oath that America's wealthiest businessmen just tried to recruit him to overthrow the U.S. government. 500,000 veterans, a march on Washington, a fascist puppet government, a real coup in America against FDR. It even had a name, the Business Plot of 1933. Congress confirmed it happened, the media called it a hoax, and history quietly buried it until now. History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're Rainy Day Rabbit Holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Bum, bum, bum.
Thank you. I was hoping you would do that.
Also, it was the Marine what? The Marine what?
The Marine what?
The Marine corpse.
Oh, yeah. I forgot I was going to do that. Dang it. I got really into my hook. So yeah, you heard that right. A literal coup in America against FDR. I mean, it didn't happen. We'll get there. The Business Plot, also called the Wall Street Pooch or the White House Pooch, if you want to speak German.
How do we spell this?
P-U-T-S-C-H.
Pooch.
Pooch.
Where you gotta get some...
Get gruff.
Get some phlegm into it.
Pooch. Yeah, I did do on Google where it pronounces it for you. It didn't quite do that. I like that. That feels more German. A little computer thing.
You gotta get it back there in the back of your throat.
Phlegm. Pooch. So now you're probably thinking, wait, I definitely would have heard about this in history class. And that's what my husband said to me last night when I was talking about it.
You're like I paid attention.
Yeah, not me. He said, I know nothing about this coup on FDR. What are you talking about? Like, because he's so into history.
Oh, wow. And you're like, I thought you paid attention in history class.
Yes, exactly.
Like you did, though. You had him do your homework.
Exactly. But you wouldn't have heard about it because the story got buried faster than an ice murder in Minneapolis and dismissed as a giant hoax, but by the media this time, and basically stripped the story from American history despite a congressional committee confirming that, yeah, this actually happened.
We're diving. Things haven't changed.
Exactly. I say that through this whole story. I'm like, oop, got to remind them we're not in 2026. We are in 1933 because this is just crazy. It's very January 6-ish.
Mm.
It's got about that much brains, too. Today, we're diving into the wildest and somehow least known story in American history. This is the tale of when corporate America looked at democracy and said, no, you're not good for business, so we're going to need to reorganize. And tried to install a fascist government because one president had the audacity to suggest that maybe, just maybe, workers deserved rights and the economy shouldn't be a playground exclusively for the ultra-rich. Again, this story is not from 2026.
Right. I'm just sitting here going, oh my God, wait a minute.
Almost every paragraph, I do a timeline reminder. Okay, so let's set the scene. It's 1933 and America's economy is a disaster. And I don't mean, oh, gas prices are high disaster. I mean, full on economic collapse. It was the Great Depression.
Right.
People selling apples on street corners or their children from their porch and Hoovervilles everywhere. That kind of disaster. So unemployment was 25%. That meant one in four Americans who wanted a job couldn't have one. Banks were failing left and right. There were 9,000 banks that collapsed between 1930 and 33.
Wow.
People's life savings, poof, gone. The stock market lost 90% of its value between 1929 and 1933. 90%.
We could be headed for that.
I know.
This year, if Europe dumps all its treasury bonds.
Farmers lost their land and families starved. It was bleak. And it didn't just happen. The result was from decades of unchecked corporate greed, speculation, and an economic philosophy that basically amounted to let the rich people do what they want, and surely it'll trickle down to everyone else.
Wait, what year are we in?
Spoiler alert, it didn't trickle down. And again, this is not 2026 yet. We learn fast around here. Workers had virtually no rights, no minimum wage, no maximum hours. Child labor was still a thing. Workplace safety, what's that? If you got injured on the job, that was your problem. And if you tried to unionize, you'd get your skull cracked by Pinkertons or a company goon. The wealth gap was obscene. The top 1% of Americans held 33% of the household wealth. What do you think it is today?
Probably more.
It is. Today, we are a larger than Depression era gap. It is the top 1% of the population holds 37% of the household wealth. Currently, the bottom 50%, so half of America has 3%. Half of America has 3%.
Wow.
That's it, of the wealth.
Yep, but let's keep cutting taxes for the wealthy.
And that doesn't even really show the disparity, because the top 1% keep their wealth in stocks and assets that gain money. So they are quickly gaining wealth just by their stuff sitting there, and they're taking it. It's a slow progression coming from the 50%. So we're losing every day while they're gaining quickly. And here's something else I found fascinating, because I'm wondering, like, you know, have we always had this large gap? But no, in 1975, the top 1% held 9% of the household.
So what was the difference then?
So the difference in that era was FDR. I'll talk about what he did in a minute, but that changed the wealth gap. And then after 1975, a few years later, enter the Reagan era, where we went back to trickle-down economics. Yep. That was his big deal.
That was
deal.
His big thing, yeah.
And we're still there. We're right back to that wage gap, or that wealth gap.
Sidebar. A certain Mad King did a press conference last week where he did some rambling speech about bars on a building that was a mental institution and in the park, and did a whole, because Democrats shut down the mental institutions.
Oh my God.
I was like, no, it was Reagan.
It was Reagan.
Reagan shut down the mental institutions.
I think the thing that pissed me off the most this week of all the horrible things he said was that NATO does nothing for us and would never do anything for us. This fucking draft dodger forgets the only time they've enacted Article 5 was for us
9/11.
After 9/11. Those countries sent their people out and they died for this fucking country.
Yep.
Shut your fucking mouth. That is so insulting. So insulting. You know, we come from a military family, veteran family.
Yep.
I'm enraged.
He's from a long line of draft dodgers. Him and his little heel spurs.
I hate him. Okay. So yeah, the system was working great if you were a Rockefeller or a DuPont.
Sure.
But for everyone else, not so much. And now in this era, it's Musk, Bezos, you know. But back to the story. It's not really about the wealth gap. I mean, that was part of the reason this happened. But now enter our protagonist, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He wins the 1932 election in an absolute landslide. And I mean, like a real one, not the Trump claim.
Mm-hmm.
He won 42 of 48 states. So he really took the win.
Who was president before
Hoover.
Okay.
And he won because the American people were sick of Herbert Hoover just going, let's wait and see if the market corrects itself. I mean, it happened in 1929. We're up to 1932 and he's still sitting around to see if it'll correct itself. So they actually picked the guy in the wheelchair because he had a plan.
Right.
He was proposing to do something. So FDR comes in hot with the New Deal. The New Deal is basically this radical idea that maybe, just maybe, the government should actually help people.
Gosh, what a novel idea.
And we're talking about job programs, banking reform, securities regulation, social security, the right to unionize, minimum wage, maximum hours, and the end of child labor. He created the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Thank you.
the Works Progress Administration. He was basically putting people back to work, building roads, bridges, dams, and schools.
Mm-hmm. The Grand Coulee Dam was one of those projects.
Yep. And so he's helping the actual citizens of this country.
Mm-hmm.
I want to call him back from the beyond.
Him and Dan Evans.
Yeah.
And we could throw in Teddy Roosevelt in there, too. I liked his. He was a mustachioed president. Do we need more mustaches on presidents? Makes them more trustworthy.
You think?
Looking, at least. Oh, yeah. I'm one of those people that thinks somebody with a mustache is more trustworthy.
Oh, wow. I'm less likely to think that way. I think.
Did your dad have a mustache growing up?
Yes.
Oh.
Cop and porn star.
What, you're saying you can't trust your local porn star?
Yeah. Well, now I have a firefighter in the family, so I guess I'm
Does he have a...
Yes, and it's hilarious.
Is it just the mustache?
Yes.
Nice.
And it cracks me up. And I've known him since he was 12. They fell in love in middle school. So I saw him grow up, and I know how long it took him to grow that. He didn't turn 18 and get a mustache. He didn't even turn 25 and get a mustache.
Do you ever say, hey, porn stash?
Oh, every time.
Good for you.
That's all Keith calls him.
It's porn stash? Yes. Fantastic. Oh, God. It's out of love.
All right. So where was I?
Sorry.
Oh, the business community, they lost their minds. And unfortunately for them, they didn't have large lobby groups. So they had to come up with a whole different plan. They had spent decades building a system where they could do whatever they wanted. They could pay workers nothing, work them to the bone, fire them for any reason, crush unions, manipulate markets, engage in insider trading, and basically run the economy as their own personal piggy bank. And now this aristocratic trader to his class, FDR came from wealth. And so that's how the wealthy people saw him, was as a traitor, because he was, you know, taking care of the non-wealthy.
Like Bernie.
Yeah. And so they saw him as a traitor. So he decided, he went to work giving workers rights and suggesting social safety nets that for people so they didn't starve.
Yeah.
And
what a novel idea.
He was quite the jerk.
What an a-hole.
So they called him a socialist, a communist, a dictator, and they said he was destroying America.
Dictator.
Killing free enterprise, ushering in tyranny.
Oh my God.
Sound familiar?
Yeah. But that was against a Democratic president. Was FDR a Democrat or Republican?
Democrat.
Okay.
These guys are Republicans trying to overturn the Democrat.
Right. But they're, once again, it's the every accusation is a confession.
Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Some of them didn't just want to complain about it. They wanted to do something about it. So here's our villains. And I call them that because they are villains. They wanted to overthrow the government. First, we have Gerald C. McGuire. This guy basically was the bag man for the whole operation. He was a bond salesman working for Grayson M.P. Murphy & Company, a Wall Street firm. He was the director of a guarantee trust and had connections to the Morgan banking interests and was the founder of the American Liberty League, which was basically a who's who of wealthy businessmen that opposed the New Deal. McGuire is also the Connecticut commander of the American Legion, which is going to be important to the story later.
Okay, Connecticut commander of the Legion?
American Legion. He was the Connecticut commander of the American Legion.
Of the American Legion, okay.
In Connecticut. And he's the guy doing the legwork, making the contracts, having the meetings. He's not quite the brains of the operation. He's more like the middle manager of treason.
Okay. That's your job title, middle manager of treason.
In 1934, McGuire takes...
Did you get promoted to that role?
I think in this case, you just take things. These are the kind of people that just take things.
Like, do you have a job review for that?
It wouldn't matter.
Performance review. Have you...
They give their own review.
Yeah, exactly. Self-reported reviews.
So to help develop this plan, McGuire takes a little trip to Europe in 1934, and not like a fun vacation to see the Eiffel Tower. He's going on a fascism study tour.
What'd you do for your gap year?
Yeah.
Fascism
so
study
he's
tour.
He's in Italy checking out Mussolini's black shirts. He's in Germany seeing how Hitler's doing his stuff. And he's also in France to observe the Croix de Feu.
Who is the politician that said best unemployment program ever in front of, was it Auschwitz?
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
That's sick.
Yeah.
That's dark. So he's literally just going there for a shopping fascism, and he's trying to figure out which authoritarian model he would like best for America.
It's like the designers that go to like Europe to shop like what's this season's fashions in Paris, but it's this season's fascism.
It's like, do I want the German style or the French? Do you have samples?
I like the French one because it has more frilly edges.
Croix de Feu.
Just sounds
better.
What does that
mean? I don't know. But basically, it's a fascist paramilitary organization.
It so it's
made up
so
of veterans.
Fancy.
I know. That's why I like that one. He is does that, select that one.
Nice cheese. There's probably a nice cheese plate that comes
yes. From now on, it's not a charcuterie tray. It's a croix de feu.
A croix de feu. I don't know. I mean, when you put it in French terms, it's not that bad.
No, exactly. That's what I was thinking.
God, it's all terrible. Let's burn it all down.
So next up is Bill Doyle, another American Legion guy. He's working with McGuire on recruitment side of things, and he's briefed to the story because he gets spooked off kind of early in the planning. But he is the commander of the American Legion in Massachusetts, which is really where his connection is.
Because can you explain what's the American Legion?
Yeah, it comes up a little bit later in the story, but basically it's their pool of veterans.
Okay.
And Robert Sterling Clark, he's the heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune. Yes. This guy is bankrolling part of the operation, and he's got millions to throw around, and he is really pissed about the New Deal. Very mad.
Tie back to the Rainmaker.
Oh, yeah.
Charles Hatfield was selling Singer sewing machines.
Gosh.
We're so good.
What year was that?
1916?
Yeah, we're not. Well, I guess we are a little bit out, but I wonder if he was still trying to make it rain.
Probably. Didn't he go on to do that for like several more decades after he drowned San Diego?
Yes. He was too successful.
Right.
Finally, there's John Davis, a lawyer who was involved in the early stages, and his main role was just funding. He didn't do a lot of the planning or the activity, but he did have a lot of money.
Sounds like a great idea. I'll give you some money.
So these are businessmen in their own right, but they're connected to a lot of high-level other businessmen.
Okay.
We're talking the DuPont family, J.P. Morgan, Remington Arms, Goodyear Tire, Standard Oil.
God.
And then, so the American Liberty League, that's not the American Legion, this is different. The American Liberty League, which I mentioned earlier, was basically a political arm of this whole anti-New Deal movement and was funded by some of the wealthiest families in America. Like early lobbying is what I was thinking.
Well, and it's interesting too, like the way they name it, like very, very, that's put very liberty in it.
Fascist.
Like we're fighting for our liberty and they're trying to take our freedoms away from us. Yeah.
It's very fascist, just like all the patriots that we see now and how they've, call themselves patriots while they go climb the walls of the Capitol and beat police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that's how they're doing. You know, they're wearing shirts that say 1776, you know, like, they're part of the revolution to keep, you know, they're fighting for America. This is very, very similar to that whole brainwashed idea. Here's where it gets interesting. McGuire and his buddies need someone to actually lead this thing because there's a problem with being a rich businessman who wants to overthrow the government. You're not exactly the guy who's going to show up and do the actual fighting. And you probably won't inspire 500,000 veterans to march on Washington. So what do? You need somebody with credibility. You need someone with military experience, someone who's beloved by veterans and the American public. You've got to sell it. Someone who's seen as incorruptible, patriotic, and a real American hero. They need someone like... Okay, before I tell you who these guys thought was going to lead their Save Democracy by Ending Democracy plan, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. Welcome back, rabbit holers.
And if you love this unhinged history and you want more of it, why don't you consider joining our Patreon? For just $5 a month, you get ad-free episodes early and you get access to a whole catalog of bonus episodes. And higher levels even get free merch and other goodies. Just visit our website, rainydayrabbitholes.com, for links.
Back to the story and on to the plan.
Oh boy, I'm excited.
The plan, as it was laid out, was to recruit a popular military figure to lead the march of 500,000 veterans on Washington, D.C. These veterans would be organized through the American Legion, which had about 1 million members at the time and was the largest veterans organization in the country. So that's why it was important to be commander of these American Legion satellites or whatever they're called, so that they had access to all these soldiers.
Wow. Okay.
Or veterans. The idea was for this massive show of force that would essentially intimidate FDR into stepping aside or becoming a figurehead. They'd install a Secretary of General Affairs, aka a dictator, who would actually run the country. FDR could stay on as president in name, but he'd have no real power. Basically, they were searching for a Stephen Miller with a prestigious military career.
Oh, God.
Right?
What?
The justification
Voldemort.
They were exactly
the face of evil.
We used to not say the name. I mean, the whole thing in Harry Potter is not to say
he shall not be named.
Now we say it
but
every time we see him.
But there's too many people that are that level of evil that you could be like, now who am I talking face about?
And you're like, ew, Voldemort. We're not even afraid of him enough to not say the name.
Yeah, I'm afraid of him, but I also despise him.
The justification they were planning to use was that FDR was too sick, too weak, and too overwhelmed to handle the job. Remember, mm-hmm. he was in a wheelchair. They'd frame it as a patriotic intervention to save the country from chaos and communism.
Can't we do that now?
Right.
Is this actually true right now?
They were prepared to spend $3 million on the operation, and that's about $70 million today.
Wow.
In today's money. They had promises of more funding if needed. Clark allegedly said that he was willing to spend half of his fortune. This was the guy that only was, that was his whole gig.
The lawyer guy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He was willing to spend half of his fortune, and that was $15 million, which
wow.
is akin to $350 million today.
Wow.
Of the models they were looking at for the fascist movement in Europe, McGuire specifically mentioned the Croix de Feu in France as an inspiration, a veterans organization that had become a powerful political force. He talked about how they could do the same thing in America.
Hmm.
Here's the chilling part. They weren't talking about this in some dark alley. These were respectable businessmen, pillars of the community, having these conversations in their offices, in their country clubs. They all genuinely believed that they were going to save America. So they were openly discussing it. They saw themselves as patriots.
Well, I mean, save America for people like them.
Exactly.
Gosh, what are millionaires going to do?
And I remember this. This is why
with
this whole thing.
Labor laws.
Right, exactly. They get to go home? They have a designated shift? I'd say they're done.
We can't have 13-year-olds in our factory?
Yeah. Rude.
That is unpatriotic. We give them cigarette breaks.
Starting at 8?
Yeah. How are we not fair?
So the American Legion, this is why they thought this would work. The American Legion was founded in 1919, right after World War I, and by 1933, it had 1 million members and veterans from the Great War. These were people who served their country. Many of them were struggling with depression.
Mm-hmm. Which we didn't do a whole lot to treat.
The Legion itself was not a monolithic organization, so it didn't have one belief. They weren't all Republicans or all had the same. They were all veterans, but they weren't all of the same political beliefs. They were progressive members, conservative members, and everything in between. But the leadership, particularly guys like McGuire, tended to be more conservative. They were all the business-connected businessmen were running these legions. The plotters figured that veterans would be easy to mobilize. These were men who were used to following orders, who had military training, and who were organized into local posts all over the country. This was really easy to access this resource. Many of them were unemployed or underemployed, and they were frustrated, angry, and looking for someone to blame for their situation. They were prime.
Like during COVID.
The plan was to use the Legion's structure to organize and mobilize these men. They would frame it as a patriotic movement to save the country. They would play on fears of communism, on resentment of the New Deal, on FDR as weak, and America needed strong leadership.
Ugh, geez.
Yep, we're still in 1933 in this story. I remember this from, I watched carefully the planning of January 6th, so I was surprised it actually took off, but I went on that app that the Parler,
yeah,
that the really the megas were using,
yeah,
and I didn't post on there, but I just would watch all this conversation.
You were just lurking.
I was lurking, and they were like planning what hotels to stay at. They were, where do you get the money if you don't have any? It was funded.
Wow.
It was planned.
Wow.
They were talking about when, where to be, what they were going to do. They were storming the Capitol. They were planning storming the Capitol, and nobody did any. I stayed home from work on that day to watch it. Because I knew it was going to happen. How did no one stop this?
But wait a minute, Jody. I thought it was all of the Capitol security FBI.
It was the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. I watched them. I watched them constantly during this time because I knew it was happening. I watched Enrique Tarrio's Parler page all the time. There was somebody Biggs on there, the Oath Keeper dude. What's his name? I can't remember their name. Stuart Rhodes. Like, I watched them because I knew that what they were doing, and they were very blatant about it. They were not hiding, yet it happened with like a surprise. But they all thought this way. They all thought they were saving America. They truly, truly believed what they were doing was right. Stunning. Here we are 90 years later.
Well, I don't think that the people that are in control right now think that they're doing the right thing or something that will help America.
Not currently. I don't believe so.
No, they have their own interests and
they
interest
care about
of
power.
People like them and power. That's all it is.
They care about power.
They don't, there's no misplaced ideology.
Greg Bovino was out in a Nazi SS trench coat. I mean, it was a small one, so it didn't drag on the ground, but he was wearing it.
Oh, yeah. You heard about the guy that they claimed was trying to do a murder for hire on him because some guy sent a meme on Snapchat.
Oh, and that's a
brother.
Oh,
that shows like
a death threat.
Grave Bovino and it said like $10,000 and something else like, ha, ha, ha.
I heard that. They dismissed it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So insane.
These guys try to act like they're such big macho men, but they're scared of everything.
Also, not only is Greg Bovino like 4'11", have you heard him talk? It is hilarious. It's like this. It's like, are you really talking like that in your Nazi outfit?
I try not to listen to any of the words they say. I like to just hear it, look at it with quotes.
I'm going to throw a pepper spray, or what is it? The
pepper ball.
Pepper ball at you. Pepper ball coming! Like, oh God, you're so scary, you little tiny fucking man.
The dog looked around at that. He was like, wow. What's that high-pitched little girl?
Oh, okay, back to the story. Where were we? Okay, the American Legion had already shown it could mobilize large numbers because in 1932, the Bonus Army of about 43,000 veterans and their families had marched on Washington demanding early payment for their World War II bonuses. I'm sorry, World War I bonuses. So they were, or this Bonus Army, they just came out for their bonus for World War I. And they had, like from 1925 to 1935, the government had that era to pay their bonus.
Oh, and they never did.
Well, they hadn't. They were still within the time frame, but these 43,000 veterans show up asking for it now. They needed their money now. It's the Depression. They have no money. There's no resources. But they were dispersed by Douglas MacArthur, and he brought in the actual army, the still active army, and dispersed them all and sent them on their way. So it didn't work, but he knew, McGuire had seen that and thought, we can mobilize a lot of them real easily and real quickly. And they're mad.
Well, they're probably still mad about that at this point.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So they still have a chip on their shoulder about not getting their bonus.
And I went too at that point. These people, everybody's starving.
Yeah.
The plotters thought they could do the same thing, but on a bigger, more organized scale. They needed 500,000 men armed if necessary to show the force that would be impossible to ignore. There was just one problem. They needed that leader, someone veterans would actually follow, and someone with impeachable credentials. They needed Smedley Butler.
Smedley?
Smedley Smedley Darlington Butler, because this guy was an absolute legend, and it's a crime that more people don't know about him. And I do believe that this story is why people don't know about him. And you'll find out what happens to him later. And I'm like, he's a hero, not only before the story, but in the story. And after the story is...
But what a name.
I know, right? He was very well known. He was famous for the things that he had completed in the Marines.
You expect there to be the third after that name.
Yeah. Smedley Darlington Butler, the third.
Right.
Wonder if there ever was. So Butler joined the Marines in 1898 when he was only 16 years old. He lied about his age to get in. And over the next 34 years, he became the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. He had two Medals of Honor, and there are only 19 people to this day that have two Medals of Honor.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. He also was awarded the Marine Corps Brevet Medal, the Distinguished Service Medal, and he served in the Philippines, China, Central America, and the Caribbean, and then Mexico and France during World War I. He fought in the Boxer Rebellion, and he was wounded multiple times. So I'm sure he had a Purple Heart too then.
Yeah.
He led the raid on Veracruz and he commanded the Marines in France.
I wonder if he had to, like, when he put on his dress uniform, like, decide which medals he was going to wear because there were too many.
Right.
Because he's like, if I wear all of these, it's just going to pull everything down. It's going to pull me forward.
I can't today. I can only do three of them. By the time he retired in 1931, so he was just newly retired-ish, as a major general and a household name, he was known as Old Gimlet Eye by the Marines. He was a genuine American hero. Veterans loved him, the public loved him, and he was seen as tough, honest, incorruptible, and fiercely patriotic. He was their guy.
Gotta look up what gimlet eye means, because it's a weird old-fashioned statement.
I feel like gimlet was
a drink.
Buttonhole, wasn't it?
An eye with a piercing stare.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, I'll talk about it in here, but there is video of him, and that would actually describe him well. He was also, by the 1930s, becoming increasingly disillusioned with the American foreign policy and the role of the military in serving corporate interests. Mm. Butler had spent decades fighting in what were essentially corporate wars. He helped secure banana plantations for United Fruit Company in Central America. He protected American business interests in China, and his own words, a high-class muscle man for big business, Wall Street, and the bankers. Mm. And he was starting to realize that this is not what I signed up for.
Right.
In 1935, so right at the end of this saga, he publishes a book called War is a Racket. And it's one of the most scathing indictments of American militarism and corporate influence ever written by someone from the inside. I'm gonna read a little quote from it. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service. And during that period, I spent most of that time as a high class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers from 1902 to 1912. I brought light into the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies. In China, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in 3 districts, and I operated mine in 3 continents.
Wow. He's jaded at this point.
He's a bit jaded. So yeah. Butler also changed his political affiliation. He had been a Republican, but by the early 1930s, he'd become increasingly sympathetic to socialist ideas. Not a full-on communist, but definitely critical of capitalism and corporate power. He supported workers' rights, veterans' benefits, was skeptical of the wealthy elite. So McGuire and his buddies decided they needed Butler to lead their fascist coup. That was a pretty big miscalculation.
Yeah.
The first approach to Butler came in 1933. McGuire and Doyle showed up at Butler's home in Newton Square, Pennsylvania. They wanted him to go to the American Legion convention in Chicago and give a speech supporting the gold standard and opposing FDR's decision to take the U.S. off the gold standard. Now, this might seem like a weird first step for the coup, but it was actually strategic. They wanted to test Butler to see if he would play ball and also use him to shift American Legion in a more conservative anti-FDR direction. Butler was suspicious from the start, but didn't particularly care about the gold standard and didn't like being used as a political prop. But he was also curious about what these guys were up to, so he played along.
He's smart, I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Over the next several months, McGuire kept coming back, and the conversations got progressively more explicit. McGuire talked about his trip to Europe and what he was doing there and the fascist movements that he studied. In one conversation, McGuire told Butler, "We need a fascist government in this country to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America."
Okay. Not quite sure how that works.
Yep. And he explained to Butler that the American Legion and how he could organize 500,000 men overnight. Butler was like, he declined the offer, but McGuire kept pushing. He talked about the money available, about the support from wealthy backers, about how Butler would be saving the country. He name dropped people who were funding this and backing it and hinted to who they were and what kind of power was there. Butler, being an actual patriot, decided to keep stringing him along, getting more information and trying to figure out how serious this was. By the summer of 1934, McGuire was getting more explicit. He talked about the plan to organize the 500,000 veterans, the actual plan to force FDR to appoint a Secretary of General Affairs who would actually run the country, and he thought Butler would be the perfect person. Butler asked what would happen if FDR refused, and he said we would just replace him. I don't know if that means kill him. Just eliminate him altogether. He finally had enough information. A coup, an actual literal coup, was going to happen. So Butler realized this was serious and weren't just some people chit-chatting. These were connected people with money and resources and actually planning this overthrow. But he was smart and he knew that he couldn't just go into public and tell his story. He'd be dismissed as crazy. These are all the powerful businessmen in the country. He needed evidence and corroboration. So enter Paul Comely French, a reporter for the Philadelphia Record and the New York Evening Post. French was a respectable journalist, a friend of Butler's, and someone Butler trusted. Butler told French the whole story and asked him to help verify it. French agreed. He went to pose as a sympathetic intermediary and meet with McGuire himself. In September 1934, French met with McGuire in his office in New York, and McGuire, apparently not the sharpest tool in the shed, basically confirmed everything Butler said.
Wow.
He talked about the plan, the money, the organization, the goal of forcing FDR out to appoint the Secretary of General Affairs. He gave names and who was giving money. French took detailed notes, and he had the corroboration, and now Butler had a witness, someone who could back up his story, and it was time to go public. But before we go public, another break from our sponsors. And we're back, rabbit holers. Back to the story. In November 1934, Butler testified before the Special Committee on Un-American Activities, also known as the McCormick-Dickstein Committee. Dickstein. I don't know. It's Dickstein. S-T-E-I-N.
Dickstein.
Named after its chairman, John W. McCormick, and vice chairman, Samuel Dickstein. I actually have never heard that name before, have you?
It can't be Dickstein.
No, it's S-T, I think Stein, S-T-E-I-N.
That's Stein. But thank you for Dickstein. Also, it says like a little bit of paprika on your Dickstein. McCormick.
Oh, got it. Oh, yeah.
Isn't that the spice company?
Yes, it is. So now, this committee had been formed to...
Chaired by Dick Stein. Oh, God. Okay, sorry, I'm done.
Now, this committee had been formed to investigate Nazi propaganda and fascist activities in the United States. So specifically for this... Yes. This mission. It was the precursor to the more famous House Un-American Activities Committee that would later go after communists in the 1940s and 50s. But in 1934, they were focused on fascism, which makes sense. This is right as World War II is happening and Hitler's and there's fascism everywhere. Butler testified under oath. He laid out the whole story, the approaches from McGuire, the conversations about organizing veterans, the plan to march on Washington, and installing a new head of government. He provided all the details, and he was very specific and credible. And you can actually see this testimony on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah, it's on there. Not the whole thing, but cuts of it. I haven't found the whole thing. I'm sure maybe you could put it all together and have the whole thing. But yeah, fascinating.
I wonder if the Library of Congress has it all.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Paul Comely French also testified, corroborating Butler's account and describing his own meeting with McGuire. The committee took testimony seriously. They investigated. They subpoenaed McGuire, who showed up and basically denied everything, claiming he'd just been having casual conversations, and Butler took it the wrong way. They subpoenaed some other people Butler had named. Most of them denied any involvement or refused to testify at all. Here's the thing, though, and it's important. Butler was basically the only major figure willing to testify publicly. Even McGuire was behind closed doors. A lot of other people who might have had information were either scared, complicit, or didn't want to be involved. Mm-hmm. The committee didn't have subpoena power over everyone they wanted to question, and some of the biggest names Butler had mentioned were never even called to testify.
Wow.
So the investigation was obviously not complete. It wasn't a full, thorough investigation. They didn't have unlimited resources or the power to compel testimony. It was a congressional committee that had limited time, limited resources, and dealing with the most powerful people in America. In February 1935, the committee released its report, and here's what it said. In the last few weeks, the committee's official life, it received, because this is when they were transitioning to the un-American committee. In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. No evidence was presented, and this committee had none to show a connection between this effort and a fascist activity in any European country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when the financial backers deemed it expedient. So read that again. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, planned, and might have been placed into execution. Yeah. The committee confirmed that the plot had been real, but they didn't recommend any prosecutions. They didn't name any financial backers publicly. They basically said, yeah, this happened, but we're not going to do anything about it. Why? Well, probably because the people involved were too powerful, too connected, and too wealthy. And again, this is not 2026. Right. It's 1933.
escaping consequences since 1933.
Sure. Longer than, I think, all time.
Yeah, basically. Anybody powerful.
Prosecuting them would have been politically explosive. It would have meant taking on some of the biggest names in American business. And in 1935, the country still was in the middle of the Depression, FDR trying to implement the New Deal, and political tensions were really high. So they decided it wasn't worth the fight. And I also read that FDR knew about this and never commented on it and never... He did not want it to get out, really. He didn't want people to have good ideas. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. This didn't work. Let me try
improve
this
on it.
I'm
going
to improve on your plan. So he kind of also wanted the whole thing to die. But what we do know is nobody was charged. Nobody went to jail. Nobody faced any end consequences. And the media response, the media gets involved at this time, and they did a number on this story. The New York Times called it a gigantic hoax. Mm-hmm. Like someone else we know that likes to go back to 1933. Time magazine mocked it, and other major newspapers either ignored it or dismissed it as the ravings of a publicity-seeking general. These newspapers, keep in mind, were owned by the wealthy businessmen, mm-hmm. the same wealthy businessmen that were connected to this coup.
Yep.
So
like the Wall Street Journal and
all of them. So they all said no.
Was it the New York Post? New York Times.
They had a vested interest in making sure the story went away. They attacked Butler's credibility. This infuriates me. They suggested he was senile, attention-seeking, and had misunderstood innocent conversations and portrayed him as a has-been trying to stay relevant. And really, he's the hero of this story. So the media narrative became, it's a hoax. Butler's crazy. Nothing to see here. And it worked. The story faded from public consciousness and became a footnote, a weird historical curiosity. But that's what the plotters wanted. And here is one other like side rabbit hole. Prescott Bush. Mm. He's the father of George H. and the grandfather of George W. And I don't have any concrete proof that he was involved in this coup, but he was friends with all these people running in all these circles. And one of the investigators, someone asked somebody on the committee if they thought Prescott Bush could be part of this coup or this group. And they thought he was particularly kind of fascist. And they said, no, I don't think he's kind of fascist. He's a full-on fascist.
Oh, wow.
This is Grandpa Bush, a full-on fascist. Anyway, that is the story of the business plot, which is an interesting name for the...
It's a very mundane milquetoast name for this very important coup. Yeah, I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, crazy. Because the media buried it and it just became... And the government didn't really want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So it just kind of made its way into the crevices.
Wow. Man, history just, it's crazy.
And that
how
is,
everything keeps
this
repeating
is,
itself.
You know, if you highlight these kind of stories and they don't fall into the crevices, then maybe people have their eye on things like the J6ers planning this crap, you know, or, you know, groups of humans that are maybe fascist and maybe they don't become president and fill an entire administration.
Yeah. And the other thing too is, you know, the way that this was kind of the media twisted it so that it died. I mean, that's happening now, but now it's happening on a daily basis.
Right.
Something comes into the news. Like you don't hear much about the fact that we invaded Venezuela and dethroned their leader.
And not only
very much
selling $500 million of oil and putting it in an offshore account that Trump is running.
And didn't he?
Not the government, not our government. Donald Trump personally is running this.
Who has benefited by $1.8 billion since he took the presidency.
Yeah, I actually heard a number. It could be as high as $3
billion. Wow. Mm-hmm. And didn't he hijack another oil tanker?
Yeah.
Like recently? But we don't hear about that because there's so much other BS.
He's running around trying to start a civil war, World War III, at the same freaking time.
Yes.
Like, we are in bad shape here.
Yes. And the problem is, like, he's demented and senile, but he has Stephen Miller behind him. And Stephen Miller's not stupid.
No, he's
just cunning.
Yeah. Evil. He's just flat out evil.
Evil, but he is cunning. Mm-hmm. And this is all part of his plan. Like, he has his thing is the wood chipper of news. Like, it's a fire hose of crap every day. So you can't focus on one story.
No, I know. And, you know, as someone who wants to be an activist, I've had a really hard time. Like, where do I point myself? Yeah. And I just recently realized this is the one that's making a movement. Like the ICE protest actually has got enough people that it will be effective. Where just showing up on a Saturday for No Kings just seems to be fun for us to do. I don't know. It's not making, this is making an impact.
Well, thank you for this. I like that we're doing a little bit more political leaning stories to kind of shed light on history of our country and other countries too, to kind of see where things like this have happened before. It's not new. How did we deal with it before? Are we still dealing with repercussions from these stories in the past? And
have we learned anything?
Yeah,
we have apparently not. So many times we do these stories, I'm like, what? Why are we still doing this way? I mean, we've known this for 100 years now, that this, like our economy, for instance, why are we back to this where 1% holds so much of the wealth? That's insane to me. And the world's richest country is what I'm told.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jody, for that great story. I really appreciate it.
It was fun. Fun.
It was a little rage inducing, but
I know, right? It was interesting. I got more and more into it as it kept going. That's why it's long.
So there was something that you mentioned in the beginning, Pinkerton.
Oh, yeah.
So we need to do an episode on the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And they're like, that.
I have a funny tale about that. I was watching one of those Old West shows. I can't remember what it was. And they kept talking about the Pinkertons, and then that's a Pinkerton. And that, and I'm like, they're all related? Why are all these people? I thought that was somebody's last name. I think I watched like 6 episodes before I looked it up. It's like, no way, they can't be related.
You've been listening to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, if you forgot already. You can find more stories like this, plus photos and sources at rainydayrabbitholes.com. Our site is built by Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's EASYBRZY.
Easy breezy.
It's breezy. Our social media wizard is Logan Hine at Redemption Industries. And you can join our Patreon for bonus episodes and ad-free listening. The link's right there on our website. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a proud member of MSW Media, and this episode was produced and edited by me, Shay.
Master editor.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm not bad. Not bad.
Not bad editor.
So thanks for listening. Stay curious and
see you down the rabbit hole.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.